Blog Talk Radio.
A tinpot dictator threatening nuclear attacks, a bare-breasted protest against possible Sharia government, unemployment is down, but so are the amount of jobs created. Hello, everyone. It's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser. Welcome, and thank you for deciding to spend the next hour with me. Got a great show for you this week. Topics include, what's really going on with North Korea? Is this something to be worried about, or is it same stuff, different Kim? Then, Amina and Famin and the blow-up over Tunisia potentially implementing Sharia. We'll also talk about how the verdict on the sequester is starting to come in, with the first monthly jobs report after budget cuts were implemented, and there is reason for concern. As always, we'll finish with our trademark weekly hall of fame and shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. If we have time, we will also have our listener feedback segment, where this week's topic will be, are corporations people, and do they deserve the same rights as people? If you want to write to me and give your opinion of that or any other topic I cover, write to makingsenseletters@yahoo.com, and I may just read your opinion on the air, regardless of whether it's in agreement with me or not. So we'll get started with our first segment right after a word from one of our sponsors.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions, and it's the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentaprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh, and clean herbals and marine notes, florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy, and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy, and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual, and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentaprises.com. Scentaprises, our business makes you sensational.
Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on, go play. Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on, get paid. All that glitters is gold.
Welcome back. What's really going on with North Korea? The situation with North Korea seems to get more serious by the minute. A miscalculation or accident could easily result in a bloody war on the Korean Peninsula. While some of this reminds one of prior escalations and intentions with North Korea, most experts are saying that these latest issues seem different, more serious, and more dangerous. The latest escalations and tensions began with North Korea testing a nuclear device in mid-February. Those tests seem timed to coincide closely with the upcoming inauguration of a new president in South Korea. It was an early test of the new South Korean government. A discussion on PBS at the time remarked how not only was there a new government coming into being in South Korea, there is a new president in China, there is a new government in Japan, and a new Secretary of State in the U.S., all of that while we are in the first year of a new and very young leader in North Korea. So some of that nuclear test was probably North Korea's new leader consolidating his power and testing boundaries with all of these new players. Immediately after the nuclear test, incoming South Korean President Park Geun-hye said that she would not tolerate any action that threatens the lives of South Korea's people and the security of South Korea. A few weeks after that test, in the first week of March, the United Nations Security Council voted to impose new sanctions on North Korea. PBS reported that China's ambassador to the United Nations, Lee Baodong, helped draft that resolution. And he remarked, quote, "We want to see full implementation of that resolution. The top priority now is to diffuse the tension and bring down the heat," end quote. So, it seems that the question of boundaries was asked and answered. North Korea replied to those answers by threatening a nuclear attack on the United States on several occasions in the last few weeks, and by Kim Jong-un ordering his rocket forces to be prepared to attack the United States. How bad has it gotten? Well, just in the last few weeks, we've seen developments where China has deployed additional forces to the border with North Korea, both in terms of troops and staging of combat aircraft. MSNBC reported that the U.S. Navy is shifting a guided missile destroyer in the Pacific to waters off the Korean Peninsula in the wake of ongoing rhetoric from North Korea. The guided missile destroyer USS Fitzgerald is capable of tracking and destroying a missile should North Korea decide to launch one. The U.S. has also sent B-2 stealth bombers and F-22 stealth fighters to participate in exercises in South Korea. North Korea has issued suggestions to ambassadors and other diplomats in Pyongyang that they should leave the country because their safety cannot be assured in the event of a war. That's pretty ominous. North Korea has shut down the hotline that it has with South Korea and is suspending cooperative economic activities like those in the Kaesong Industrial Zone. This is a particularly worrisome sign, as Reuters notes that the economic activity in this zone generates $2 billion a year in trade for the impoverished North and $80 million in cash wages that go straight to North Korea's government. It's a big deal if a country like North Korea is giving that up, because it's like a poor person who's starving to death rejecting food or financial help from somebody. They'd have to really be hostile to that person to do it. North Korea has also said that they intend to resume enrichment of fissile material for nuclear weapons production at the Yongbyon nuclear plant. This is the same plant that the North Koreans dismantled 5 years ago, the last time significant progress was made in negotiations. North Korea is also preparing one or two medium-ranged rockets for what seems to be a test launch on the eastern part of their country. South Korea's new president instructed their military that if preparations in the north begin to indicate that an attack is imminent, that South Korean forces can launch a preemptive attack on the north. This preemptive attack would be aimed at North Korea's nuclear sites, its missile sites, and presumably their artillery. Now, one could hardly blame the South Koreans for considering a preemptive attack. Now, I try to imagine what it would be like living in a country within range of 10,000 artillery pieces and all of the rest of the weaponry the North Koreans have, and have my heavily armed neighbor to the north threaten death, destruction, and invasion every few years. I mean, that think about that. That's got to get old really quickly. You know, I think at some point, any people in that situation would tell their government to put an end to this one way or the other. For all of the ominous signs that I just outlined, and you know, there's a lot of them, the one sign that we haven't seen is North Korea moving more troops to its border with South Korea. An April 6th article in The Economist pointed out that it's thought that three-quarters of North Korea's 1.1 million troops are always stationed within 60 miles of the demilitarized zone with South Korea, with reportedly 10,000 artillery pieces capable of hitting South Korea's capital, Seoul. But South Korean and American intelligence aren't suggesting that there's any unusual troop movement in the north. So, conventionally, North Korea doesn't seem to be preparing for war. The situation hasn't yet gone that last critical step, but the situation remains very dangerous. One misstep by a fighter pilot on either side, or an overzealous artillery officer, or any number of imaginable scenarios could result in a devastating conflict. If this plays out like previous escalations, this brinksmanship will be followed by negotiations and a settlement that involves food and other humanitarian aid being sent to North Korea. But would Kim Jong-un be open to such negotiations? He's the big question mark here. What does Kim Jong-un want? What kind of person is he? We know that Kim Jong-un went to boarding school in Switzerland under an assumed name until he was about 15 years old. We know he has obtained 2 degrees in North Korean university, including 1 in physics. Beyond that, we just don't know that much about him in the West. Just thinking about the few things that we do know about him, I wonder if any 29-year-old is mature enough to be ready to be leader of a country, let alone a quote-unquote dear leader, where he's considered a demigod with a cult following. What would being dear leader do to a young person's psyche? We know what instant success and fame and tons of money does to some of our child stars here, and they don't have the power of Kim Jong-un. I think that President Obama has only one way to play this. He has to make sure that we're adequately prepared if North Korea decides to attack the South or launches missile strikes against Japan or other nearby countries. And at the same time, he has to find a way to reach out to find a negotiated settlement. While managing all of that, he can't give away too much. Because we don't want to positively reinforce these periodic tantrums and thus make the North Koreans more likely to do them again in the future. That's a really difficult balance to strike. I should mention that we know one other thing about Kim Jong-un. He loves NBA basketball. He and Dennis Rodman seem to have struck up an improbable friendship while Rodman was in Pyongyang as part of a delegation of American basketball players playing in an exhibition game. So is that the key? Should we offer to have more basketball exhibition games in Pyongyang as a sort of diplomatic icebreaker with North Korea, like Nixon used ping pong with China? I wouldn't have any problem with that. I don't think that would be a bad thing to do. I don't think Kim Jong-un wants war. I think he's a young guy trying to project a strong image and looking to solidify his position as North Korea's leader. It's an old game that many leaders have played, some continue to play. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad as one example. You stand up, you make this big show of defying the United States, the world's preeminent military power. It gives the appearance to your people that you're a strong leader, regardless of whether or not it's true. You know, at the end of the day, regardless of Kim's motives, we all have to try to find a way out of this. And I think we all have to hope that the final act of all of the chest puffing, the bluster, the saber rattling, isn't a conflict that leaves hundreds of thousands of soldiers and civilians dead and the Koreas a smoldering ruin. We'll be right back. What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze Diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze Diamond and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze Diamond Jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, BADLER.com, or search Blaze Diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos. Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets. Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R. Next up, Amina and Famine and the blow-up over Tunisia potentially implementing Sharia. Since the Arab Spring changes in Tunisia, there's been an uneasy relationship between the more secular elements in Tunisia's government and the more religiously conservative Salafist networks like Ansar al-Sharia in Tunisia, or AST. Excuse me. As Aaron Zellin from the Washington Institute points out in his 2011 piece, The Salafi Challenge to Tunisia's Nascent Democracy, Tunisia's new openness has allowed Salafi elements to widely propagate their message, one that undergirds the intellectual foundations of jihadism, and as such poses a potential danger to the country's stability. Mr. Zellin's piece notes that AST's largest advocacy project has been raising awareness of the plight of Muslim prisoners, most notably Tunisians who fought with Al-Qaeda in Iraq, AQI, during its height in 2005 to 2007, and whom remain in Iraqi jails. The group has also demanded the release of Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, the blind religious leader of Egypt's al-Gamaa al-Islamiyya, who was convicted and imprisoned in the United States for his role in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, and Abu Qatada al-Filistini, al-Qaeda's European spiritual leader currently serving time in Britain. In addition to holding peaceful sit-ins outside the Iraqi embassy in Tunis, AST has demonstrated in front of the Tunisian Ministry of Foreign Affairs to call for the release of a handful of its quote-unquote brothers, many of whom are self-described members of Al-Qaeda. Additionally, AST's Facebook page posted a music video placing a recently executed Iraqi terrorist convicted of bombing two Shiite tombs among two other illustrious quote-unquote martyrs, Osama bin Laden and Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. While that is disturbing, more to the point of our segment is that AST, as their name suggests, is for instituting strict Islamic Sharia law in what up until now has been a fairly liberal Tunisia. AST already has paramilitaries patrolling various neighborhoods and bullying those who act in ways that are contrary to Sharia law. There's a real struggle between groups like AST and the secular groups in Tunisia for control of the country. There's no question that if the Salafists gain power, they will institute Sharia law in Tunisia. The implications of Sharia implementation are wide-reaching and would affect every citizen of that country, but particularly Tunisia's women. Many women in Tunisia are concerned about the possibility of the Salafists coming to power. 19-year-old Amina is one of those women. Amina, who goes by the pseudonym Amina Tyler, touched off a storm of controversy when she posted three pictures of herself on the Facebook page belonging to the Tunisian branch of the feminist group known as Femen. In the pictures, Amina was topless, and she had different words printed on her body, or painted on her body, in each of the pictures, saying in English and in Arabic, among other things, "My body is my own and not the source of anyone's honor," and "blank your morals," where blank is that most famous vulgarity in the English language starting with the letter F. As I noted, this touched off a massive controversy. It has the Salafists in Tunisia up in arms. According to The Atlantic's Jeffrey Taylor, Amina's parents grabbed her and deposited her in a psychiatric hospital, while the head of the Commission for the Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice in Tunisia, Almi Adel, a Salafi Islamic preacher, has called for Amina to be stoned to death for posting the images. Talk about validating her protest. He warned that Amina's action could cause epidemics and disasters and could be contagious and give ideas to other women. Media reports say Tunisian secular law would punish her with up to 2 years in prison. Adding to the controversy, Femen rushed to Amina's defense by staging what they called an international topless jihad day, with Femen activists in several cities and locations staging topless protests and shouting and painting themselves with slogans like, "Our boobs are stronger than your stones," and the aforementioned blank your morals. Amina and Feynman's actions touched off a broader controversy about feminism. Amina and Feynman's actions have been met with both support and criticism from feminists in the Arab world and the West. Anti-Feynman women in the Arab world staged what they called a day of Muslima pride, where some Muslim women posted pictures of themselves saying that Feynman doesn't speak for them, with accusations of Western imperialism and all of those sorts of things. Of course, the problem with that is Amina is Tunisian, so Western imperialism charges and charges of cultural jingoism don't really work so well. But nor were Muslim women the only ones who objected. There were Western feminists who claimed that Amina and Feynman were objectifying themselves by showing bare breasts, and that was confusing the message. An Al Jazeera show featured a video conference between Feynman spokesperson Ina Shevchenko and a group of feminists from around the world, and several of those feminists attacked Feynman's method of protest. But of course, there were many more Muslim women and Western feminists who supported Amina and Feynman, including several on that Al Jazeera show. I'm not in favor of theocracies of any religion, and I'm certainly not in favor of fundamentalist theocracies. I'm opposed to any government that bases their laws and punishments on religious texts. And I can understand why women in particular would object to governments that base their laws on religious texts, since most interpretations of religious texts, I want to make that distinction clear, most interpretations of religious texts place women in subservient roles to men at best, and at worst assigns women the role and value of chattel. One of the interesting things about this whole controversy was the reaction, though, of some of those Western feminists. A subset of Western feminists cannot get over the fact that Feynman uses nudity to get attention and thus to help get their message out. I happen to think it's a particularly strong form of protest, because part of what determines whether a protest is effective is whether people are paying attention. Amina and Feynman, whatever else you say about them, accomplish that with this protest. No questions about it. I don't think the criticism of Amina and her protest is fair. She's risked her life to do it. She risked her life to draw attention to the dangers of Tunisia falling into fundamentalist hands. There is a big question as to whether she'll be executed for what she did, and what she's protesting is a serious issue. Will Tunisia's emerging democracy move forward into the 21st century? Or will the Salafists prevail, implement Sharia, and move Tunisia back into the 8th century? If the Salafists prevail, Tunisia could well become a haven for the worst extremist elements in Asia Minor, like Al-Qaeda. Several Salafist groups, as I indicated earlier, seem to revere Al-Qaeda figures as heroes. So while Amina's protest is about the plight of women in Tunisia and the threat to women's rights if Tunisia comes under the grips of the Salafists, and that's extremely important, and I support her and I support Feynman, there are broader implications here that everyone in the world should find concerning. Making sense. We'll be right back.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions, and is the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentaprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh, and clean herbals and marine notes. Florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy, and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy, and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual, and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentaprises.com. Scentaprises, our business makes you sensational.
Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on, go play.
Welcome back. Now it's time for our listener feedback section, where we pose a question and you send in your emails about how you feel about an issue. Our topic this week, are corporations people? Should they have the same rights of people? This is a segment I've been hoping to get the chance to play. I haven't had time in the last few weeks, but I think it's an important topic. The legal issue of corporate personhood goes back to Supreme Court cases like the 1819 Trustees of Dartmouth College v. Woodward and an 1886 decision, Santa Clara County v. Southern Pacific Railroad. That latter case is the source of a lot of controversy, as the part that pertains to corporate personhood was not actually decided by the court, but added to the headnote by a court reporter. That headnote became part of the official decision. And that decision is still cited today as one of the justifications for corporate personhood. Now, despite that controversy, the Supreme Court has affirmed the idea of corporate personhood many times before and since the Santa Clara County v. Southern Pacific Railroad case. But it raises many issues. Just off the top of my head, I would ask, does that grant too much power to corporations? And do corporations get both the benefits and responsibilities of personhood, or just the benefits? For instance, if the draft comes back, I could be drafted, along with, you know, millions of other people. How does a corporation participate in that responsibility? The unemployment benefits that I and other people can receive if we get laid off just went down as a result of the sequester. How are corporations affected by that? In fact, it seems like that just gave corporations more money, since corporations pay a part of a laid off employee's unemployment benefits. People can't be too big to fail. If a person takes on more debt than they can handle, they go bankrupt. But big corporations and banks can grow to the point where the federal government will bail them out of their bad decisions. Not only that, but the taxpayers end up picking up the tab for it. Those are some of the ways corporations have it much better than regular people. What about the power that corporations can amass as a result of their wealth? Well, the wealthiest person in the world is Carlos Slim from Mexico. He's the telecom magnate. And he has an estimated $73 billion in wealth. I'm sure Mr. Slim is not someone with whom a regular person would want to get into any kind of litigation. If we compare Mr. Slim to the world's wealthiest corporations, though, well, the top 58 revenue-generating corporations, private corporations in the world, take in considerably more in revenue each year than Mr. Slim's total net worth. And about that many companies have a market capitalization higher than Mr. Slim's net worth. And many more corporations have a similar net worth to his. The bottom line is that a regular person can't hope to have the political influence, the standing in the courts, or compete any other way with the vast majority of corporations out there. A corporation's ability to throw money at a dispute with a regular person will 99 times out of 100 effectively destroy the rights of that person in terms of that dispute. Laws and policies that further attempt to give corporations the same rights of regular people in terms of the political process further exacerbate the situation. In particular, Citizens United v. Federal Election Commission was a 2010 ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court that prohibited the government from restricting independent political expenditures by corporations. That's still the law of the land in the United States. We have a situation where the corporations can create political ads that help various candidates and issues whose actions may be harmful or otherwise highly undesirable by a large percentage of the citizenry in a jurisdiction. But that citizenry's voice will be drowned out at election time by the corporation's political expenditures. Does it make sense to allow corporations to do this? They have all the benefits of personhood, few of the responsibilities, and can overwhelm the resources of real people to have themselves heard. That's a really bad thing, in my opinion. You know, I was overseas in Kenya a year and a half ago, and talking to regular people on the street, one of the things that they remarked is how much more corruption that Kenya has than the United States, how they wish they had things in like they are in the United States. And I said, well, you know, I'm not so sure that's true. And they looked at me very surprised, the folks that I said that to. And I said, well, obviously in the United States, if I commit a crime, I can't pay off the judge. I can't pay off the prosecutors. That kind of corruption, that doesn't exist in the United States. But we have an institutionalized corruption in terms of what I was just talking about here, Citizens United. Corporations, if they want laws that make it easier for them to pollute, if they want to do, you know, all kinds of other things, just put ads out there attacking the candidates who oppose them. Flood the airways with those ads. They can get what they want. That's institutionalized corruption. Does it make sense to allow corporations to do this? On Tuesday, March 12th, Bernie Sanders, the independent senator from Vermont, and Democratic Representative Ted Deutch of Florida, they introduced a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United and thus would allow state legislatures and the federal government to pass laws limiting the amount of money that a corporation could spend to create ads to support candidates and issues. I think that would be a great start. Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig put out a book at the beginning of last year called Republic Lost: How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. And that book, as the title suggests, outlines how corrupting the influence of corporate money is in politics and steps we can take to stop it. This is a terrible situation that we have in this country with the influence of corporations and corporate money in the political process. What do you think? Write to me at makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. That's makingsenseletters@yahoo.com, no spaces. And I may read your letter on the air next week. We'll be right back. What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze Diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze Diamond and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze Diamond Jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, Badler.com, or search Blaze Diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos. Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets. Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R. Welcome back. The verdict on the sequester starts to come in with the first monthly jobs report after budget cuts were implemented, and there is reason for concern. Last week, the job numbers came in along with several other important economic metrics. The unemployment rate dropped from 7.7% to 7.6%, and while that sounds good, the facts behind it are not. Only 88,000 jobs were created in March. Most of the drop in unemployment came from nearly 500,000 discouraged and retiring workers leaving the workforce. The trend since a few months after the president has been in office and started turning the economy around is that we have created an average of somewhere around 150,000 jobs per month. So why are we creating less jobs all of a sudden? The answer is simple. The sequester. The sequester cuts approximately $85 billion in spending this year from various federal programs, and that includes several kinds of cuts that result in lower outlays to the states for things like education. As Think Progress reports, the automatic spending cuts that went into effect at the start of March are spread out over a host of domestic programs and are having a real impact on communities across the country. Sequestration is cutting jobs, shutting down essential services, and hurting state economies. All told, sequestration is predicted to reduce GDP growth from 2.6% to 2% to 2013, and it's expected to eliminate some 700,000 jobs by the end of 2014. Social Security, Medicaid, some anti-poverty programs, military pay, and the ongoing costs of the war are exempted. But Medicare's provider payments, the military's overall budget, and non-defense discretionary spending are all getting hit. In the March unemployment and economic numbers, we see just the very beginning of the effects of the sequester. Those of you who have been following my show know that I have done several segments in February and early March warning about what the effects of the sequester would be. I never do multiple shows on a subject unless I think that it is really important. Now we're seeing why. Republicans, well, they made fun of warnings about the sequester issued by President Obama and other Democrats like me. The fact is that, as I've said before, the sequester is a reverse stimulus. It's depressing. In a stimulus, you increase government spending to jolt the economy into moving again and creating jobs. The president's economic stimulus passed in February of 2009 reversed the massive monthly losses of jobs he inherited from the Bush administration, and it resulted in several years of consistent job growth where over 5 million jobs were created. That's what a stimulus can do. That's what increasing the federal government spending can do. If we reduce money being spent by the federal government, it's going to have the reverse effect. It's going to slow down economic growth, and it's going to reduce job creation, perhaps to the point where we are losing more jobs than we are creating. That's why President Obama and Democrats like me were saying, hey, let's find a way to stop the sequester. Republicans didn't care. They still don't. We Democrats were saying, let's not do this. Let's negotiate. This is bad for jobs. This is bad for the economy. Let's find a solution where we both get some of what we want and we don't hurt the economy. The Republicans didn't want to talk about it. And folks, if you will allow me the grammar faux pas for the effect, we ain't seen nothing yet. In the March numbers, we saw just a hint of what the sequester is going to do to jobs and to the economy. Most economic experts say that the full effect of the sequester would not start to hit until April. For one thing, because of the way the law is worded, federal employees could not be furloughed until April. Some of that's going on as we speak. Many of the cuts are going to take several weeks to filter down and be felt by the economy. I expect the April and May numbers to be worse than March. I think there's a good chance that we will see job losses rather than job creation. And I think we will see economic contraction in at least one upcoming quarter, and perhaps even two in a row, which is the basic definition of a recession. When that happens, who do you think Republicans are going to blame? Do you think Republicans are going to accept responsibility for refusing to negotiate on the sequester? Of course not. When the worst of the economic effects of the sequester are felt, Republicans are going to be all over the airwaves telling everyone they can get to listen to them that the president's economic policies don't work and that the problems are his fault. Just watch. Okay, that's an easy prediction to make, right? When have the Republicans ever accepted their share of responsibility for anything bad happening? Have we ever heard Republicans say that they were responsible for the economic collapse of the last 2 years of the Bush presidency? I mean, if they didn't take responsibility for that, they're certainly not going to take responsibility for the sequester. The maddening thing about this is I'm just not sure that much can be done about it. President Obama and the Democrats in the Senate cannot reverse the sequester on their own. The House of Representatives, controlled by the Republicans, would have to agree to any changes, and they will not do that. They're happy to have the economy go into recession to gain the political advantage that they think it will give them. That's something really important that we should remember about Republicans. They are happy to have this happen. The whole sequester issue is like Republicans winning the trifecta. They finally got spending cuts on the economy passed. They got to seem strong to their base by standing up to President Obama and the Democrats. And it's going to hurt the economy, and they're going to blame that on the president, too. Folks, the only thing that we can do is make sure that the message gets out there. Back at the end of February, I posted on my blog at stevelazer.blogspot.com the president's proposal to avoid the sequester. President Obama's plan was, and still is, a set of carefully architected cuts that would not have the effect the sequester is going to have on the economy. We have to let people know that the sequester is the cause of our current economic issues, and that President Obama had a different plan, and Republicans refused to listen to him, and they let this happen on purpose. Before the sequester, we had economic growth and job creation. After the sequester, those things stopped, just as President Obama and Democrats like me suggested that it would. The Republicans still let it happen on purpose. Maybe we can put enough pressure on Republicans to force them back to the negotiating table with the president to reverse the sequester and put jobs ahead of politics. But to do that, we've got to get the word out there. Making Sense with Steve Lazer will be right back with our Hall of Fame and Shame after this.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions, and it's the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentaprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh, and clean herbals and marine notes. Florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy, and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy, and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual, and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentaprises.com. Scentaprises, our business makes you sensational.
Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on, go play. Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on, get paid. All that glitters is gold.
And now it's time for our weekly Hall of Fame and Shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. First, our Hall of Fame for making sense. Winning the Hall of Fame this week for making great sense is Senator Bill Nelson from Florida. Beyond the big issues of the Supreme Court cases and states approving gay marriage, there are a lot of more minor but still significant actions going on in the fight for LGBT equality, and one of those is that one by one, all Democratic elected officials who previously indicated they were opposed to gay marriage are reversing those positions. This week, we had a big one. Senator Bill Nelson from Florida, one of the big swing states, has reversed his position on gay marriage. In a statement to the Tampa Bay Times editorial board, Senator Nelson wrote, "It's generally accepted in America law and U.S. society today that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I believe that the civil rights and responsibilities for one must pertain to all." Thus, to discriminate against one class and not another is wrong for me. If we are endowed by our Creator with rights, then why shouldn't those be attainable by gays and lesbians? Well put, Senator Nelson. A note of personal trivia. Senator Nelson's 2000 election campaign was one of the first for which I ever volunteered, and today I am particularly proud of having been involved with his campaign. Congratulations to Senator Bill Nelson, the Democrat from Florida, for winning this week's Hall of Fame for making great sense. Now our Hall of Shame this week for those politicians and prominent individuals who made shameful nonsense. In third place this week in our Hall of Shame, we have the chairperson of Georgia Republicans, Sue Everhart. The blog Joe My God reported on an interview in the Marietta Daily Journal Online with the head of Georgia State Republicans. This is an interesting contrast with Senator Nelson that I just talked about. You see, GOP Chairperson Everhart repeated as many of the canards regarding the LGBT community she could fit in as little space as possible. She talked about gay parents influencing their child's orientation. She suggested that LGBT couples are not natural because they don't have, quote, the equipment to have a sexual relationship, end quote. All of that is pretty awful and bizarre, but it isn't anything that we haven't heard before. But then she threw in this gem and invented a bizarre new reason to be against gay marriage, where she tries to assert that if gay marriage is legal, straight people will be induced to commit fraud. I really worked on trying to say that without laughing. She said to the Marietta Daily Journal, quote, "You may be as straight as an arrow, and you may have a friend that is straight as an arrow. Say you had a great job with the government where you had this wonderful health plan. I mean, what would prohibit you from saying that you're gay and y'all get married and still live as separate, but you get all the benefits? I just see so much abuse in this, it's unreal. I believe a husband and a wife should be man and a woman. The benefits should be for a man and a woman. There is no way that this is about equality. To me, it's all about a free ride," end quote. Now, there are a lot of crazy things to point out about that, but let me just say to Ms. Everhart that a large percentage of companies that offer benefits today to their employees offer same-sex domestic partner benefits that requires very little in the way of documentation to prove that someone is your domestic partner. A same-sex friend doesn't need to marry the person to get on their health care plan. As the chair of one of the two main parties in a large state, I think you should have known that, ma'am. The head of Georgia Republicans, Sue Everhart, is third this week in our Hall of Shame for worst nonsense of the week. In second place for even worse nonsense this week, we have Dudley Brown. Dudley Brown is the founder and head of the Rocky Mountain Gun Owners and a former NRA lobbyist. So he was a big shot with the NRA. Why did he leave? He left them because they were not extremist enough. Think Progress reports that Brown left the NRA in the 1990s because he felt the NRA was, quote, kissing up to politicians, end quote. The NRA at the time blasted Mr. Brown and the Rocky Mountain Gun Owners as, quote, an extreme right gun group, and called Brown the Al Sharpton of the gun movement for his inflammatory approach. Yeah, that's right. This guy and his group were blasted by the NRA as an extreme right gun group. So you just know there's all kinds of crazy going on there. Well, Think Progress reported on an interview NPR did with Mr. Dudley Brown last week, in which Mr. Brown was, as one would expect, complaining about Democrats' positions on gun laws. Mr. Brown complained that universal background checks are just a step towards identifying gun owners so the government can seize their weapons. And he calls the 15-bullet limit on ammunition clips arbitrary. He's promising political payback in next year's election that could cost Colorado Democrats their majorities. Then Mr. Brown said this.
I liken it to the proverbial hunting season. We tell gun owners there's a time to hunt deer, and the next election is the time to hunt Democrats.
It's so much fun to use imagery from guns and killing that makes humorous double entendres about killing your political opponents, right? That's funny, right? Well, in the wake of the recent shooting of a prosecutor in Texas and of the shooting of Congressman Gabby Giffords, no, it's not funny. Dudley Brown of the Rocky Mountain Gun Owners is runner-up this week in our Hall of Shame for making nonsense. But the award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week goes to President Barack Obama. Yes, to President Obama. I hate giving the president this dubious honor. I'm a big fan of the president. So let me say that even our favorite people sometimes do crazy and nonsensical things. That's the essence of being human. And this week was a doozy for the president. I have a feeling that the president and his senior folks at the White House met on Friday and just said, you know what's the best part of this week? That it's over. The president did two nonsensical things this week. One of them nobody's going to remember a week from now. And the other is something that unfortunately is forever going to be part of his legacy, and that's really a shame. The mistake that he made that no one is going to be talking about a week from now is to refer to California Attorney General Kamala Harris as, quote, the best-looking attorney general in the country, end quote. With the issues that women face in the workplace, trying not to be judged on looks but rather on performance, that statement was definitely a goof, and the president, he knew it, and he apologized. But the more serious issue, is that the president offered to cut Social Security and Medicare in his budget proposal this week. Now, this was a proposal that was wrong in every way imaginable. It's wrong to do this to seniors, some of whom are living on only the meager amount per month that Social Security provides. But it was also wrong for the political calculation that it would work and be embraced by Republicans and produce an agreement. I mean, that was wrong. And look at what the result is for the president at the end of the day. Boehner ridiculed his proposal. The president's base is mad at him. He has no budget agreement. And he's given the Republicans the permanent talking point and precedent that a Democratic president has proposed to cut Social Security and Medicare. I've talked about this on my show before. You can bet that when we next have a Republican president, that he or she will propose big cuts to Social Security. And when the Democrats object, that administration will respond, well, a Democratic president already offered to cut these programs, so it can't be that bad. Just wait. That's what's going to happen. There are a ton of other options in terms of cuts, like the defense budget, that the president could have proposed cutting that wouldn't harm some of the most vulnerable people in the country. Mr. President, I'm a big fan. I think you're great. But this was the worst mistake of your presidency so far. And as a result, you win this week's award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week. That's all I have for today's show. Thank you for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio this Sunday, April 14th, and Monday, April 15th at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KCAA Radio, 1050 a.m. in Inland Empire, California. Be sure to follow me and the show on Twitter at Stephen Laser and on Facebook at Making Sense with Steve Laser. Until next time, have a great rest of your day and a great week.